Live and in color from the NBC News Radio Broadcasting Studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California and in parallel from the Turf Sup Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Thanks for tuning in to the Water Zone Show this evening.
And hello again, and welcome to the Water Zone Show today, and we appreciate you listening in. I'm Rob Starr, along with my acclaimed co-host here, Mr. Chris Davies. Chris Davies, how are you today?
I think I'm claimed as well as acclaimed, Rob, but that's okay if you want to say that. I'm fine. I'm working at home all this week, and in between time on lunch hour, I watch the political variety show on TV every day.
So did I say reclaimed?
I don't know if you said reclaimed, acclaimed, or claimed.
Well, I'll claim you any day. You're a good person to be on the show, so we'll keep it going. So, but anyway, you know, just so our listeners know, and I think we mentioned it before, you have been, or you will be, indoctrinated. I use that word instead of indicted into the Green Industry Hall of Fame coming up. And in the next couple of weeks, and we're very proud of you for that. You've had an illustrious career. I know I joke around with you and say stupid words and things, but I truly mean you've been a good friend, a great host of this show, and without you and behind this thing, I don't think we'd go as far as we did, and I really appreciate that. And it's long time overdue, and congratulations, and we'll be celebrating that as we go along.
So, yeah, thanks, Rob. Thanks
for doing that. And then we had something else that happened to us that they announced today. And, Chris, you want to talk about that, what was announced with the EPA?
Sure. Yep, certainly. So the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, for a fifth consecutive year has awarded the Toro Company, you know, our day jobs, right, with the prestigious award for innovation for the WaterSense program. So, I mean, just an awesome thing to get that once, but to get it five times in a row, Rob, I mean, it's just marvelous.
Yeah, they say we do good education outreach to everybody, and that's really what the whole premise of the show was.
That's right.
And is. And so we're very happy to do that. And another person who contributes greatly to the show, and we're blessed to have her, is Chris Austin, who's the owner and purveyor of Maven's Notebook, who gives anything and everything about California water news. So Miss Maven, as I joke with you, please come on.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Good, Chris.
Everyone staying healthy, staying cool. What wonderful weather in Southern California today.
Finally.
Yeah. Although it's all going to heat up again, so I'm told. So don't mean to bust your groove, but, you know.
Another heat wave this weekend, yeah.
Yeah.
It was lower today in the mid-90s, but a constant breeze. But it was really nice, really dry, no moisture. But it's supposed to cool off for the weekend here. So, again, we're all doing this for our listeners, all remote from all over the place. And we can't go to the studios. Nobody wants to get COVID, and they take precautions there. So a lot of shows are being done remotely as ours. But for California water news, there's a couple of things of interest that I read this morning in the Maven's Notebook. And one is that the California water managers are really not ready for climate change. And just maybe you can give us a little background to that and why they say that.
Yeah, you know, this was a study that was done by the Union of Concerned Scientists and University of Texas. And they were looking at our infrastructure and what sort of coming down the line with climate change. And, you know, we've really seen this in the past years. We went from, you know, the deep drought year, one of the driest that we've ever had, and then the next year was one of the wettest we ever had. And in that, you know, really wet year also was, you know, the failure of the Oroville spillway. So, you know, our infrastructure isn't really engineered to be able to deal with the types of extreme climate events that we might have. And this takes, you know, some changes in infrastructure. It also takes some changes in operations. And So all these things, you know, need to be taken into account. And it always seems, I think, as the researchers say, you know, we're always sort of lagging behind things. You know, we have to see it first and then we respond to it. But with this climate change and the things that are being forecast, we really need to start being better prepared for what hasn't happened yet but could happen, rather than reacting to, you know, something that was really bad that did a lot of damage. And we're going to need to do some fortification and some rethinking of our infrastructure, as well as rethinking how we operate things, because as we kind of keep progressing with the things that are progressing with, you know, the climate, you know, things are getting, you know, very much volatile, and we have to be prepared for that. And the snowpack is going, you know, they're talking about the snowpack at the lower elevations no longer being there and what that impact is to our water supply. So we also need to be making changes on how we take the water when it comes. And there's a lot of things to be done, and they're really warning that we need to be on the leading edge of this and not, you know, in a reactive state, but in a proactive state. So that's kind of what that study was about.
Do you think water agencies are all getting aboard on this thing? I do. I really believe they're all gearing up for this some have already got their plans in place, and some are still trying to develop them out to the future. But I'm sure they'll be modified year after year after year because of the changing environment and so forth. And
I will agree. You know, there are some, you know, agencies that are really on the leading edge of this, and there are some agencies that, you know, necessarily aren't. And this is something, you know, preparing for these things is not just large scale, but it's also local scale and regional scale. And it's, you know, getting those people involved. The problem is that on a local scale, on a regional scale, you don't always have the funding resources available to those communities to do the things they need to do. So this is something that, you know, we really need to take into effect or into account next time we have a bond measure that's, you know, labeled climate resilience. We need to start putting money out to the communities in the regional areas to be able to do projects that help with flood control and drought, you know, mitigation and those things. So, you know, there isn't a bond like that on the ballot yet or anything in the works, but that's something important that we're going to need to do in the future.
Without a doubt. So I also saw that Attorney General in California, Becerra, sends a comment letter challenging the Shasta Dam increase in size, the raise of that. And I guess he's not in favor of that at all.
Well, you know, this is a long-standing thing. And, you know, they've been talking about raising Shasta Dam for, you know, really decades. It actually stems back to this program called CalFed in the, like, early 2000s that tried to, you know, it was a state and federal effort to try to solve water problems in California, and one of those was storage. So they were looking at storage projects. So theoretically, this project has literally been 20 years in the making. There's a lot of problems with raising Shasta Dam. For one, it's going to flood out more Indian, you know, sacred sites and, you know, what's really left of a lot of, like, the Winnum and Wintus native heritage sites. And that's just one thing. It's not going to get that much more water. And if we're listening to the science, the scientists are saying that the water isn't going to come from snowpack up in the mountains anymore. It's going to be coming in these warmer storms called atmospheric rivers that are dropping major amounts of water below these dams, below Shasta Dam. And there are very few, if any, reservoirs that can pick up that water that falls on the valley floor. There's a reservoir project that they're starting to work on. They haven't started construction, but they're in the final phases of planning, and that's called Sites Reservoir, and that's located sort of midway down the Sacramento River in the Sacramento Valley. It's not an on-stream reservoir, so it's not blocking any river, but it's a you know, if anybody in Southern California has been out to Diamond Valley Lake, what they did is they found a valley that was kind of surrounded by a bunch of mountains, and they just dammed it up and made a reservoir there. And there's actually, I think, like four dams at Diamond Valley, and that's the same thing they're going to do here, is they're just going to dam up these mountains and create a reservoir there. It's not on a river, so it's not going to, you know, impede any salmon migration or anything like that. They'll pump it up to the reservoir, and the whole premise of this reservoir is to take those storms when they are dumping water on the valley floor and put that water in the reservoir. That, I think, seems to me like a better project. Not like I take any position on anything, so no one should ever construe that as a position. But it seems to me that the science is saying that Sites Reservoir would be a better project, perhaps, than raising Shasta Dam, which comes with a lot of baggage. And, you know, there's a lot of things that the Attorney General raised in his letter to the Bureau of Reclamation. You know, they didn't look at this, they didn't look at that, and, you know, but, you know, bottom line is there are few supporters in the state for this project. And, mm-hmm. you know, and there's no state or local partner with the federal government, which is my understanding, in order to build this, that the federal government cannot impose a water project on any state if they don't want it. So Right. They have to have a state or a local partner to do this project with. And then they have to get through all the environmental reviews and yada, yada, yada. And there is no state or local partner that can do that. Westlands tried to do that, but there's a clause in the state legislature that says that no state agency can participate in the raising of Shasta Dam. And as it turns out, Westlands Water District, these irrigation districts, are actually, you know, considered agencies of the state. So they can't participate. So they don't have a state or local partner. So I don't know how they're going to build this. It's interesting to see what they're going to do. When we were talking water storage with Prop 1, there was nobody really talking about Shasta Dam. As a matter of fact, raising Shasta Dam wasn't even one of those projects proposed for the water storage fund. So, you know, it's interesting. I would have never thought it would have gained this momentum that it's gained. And it really seems to be coming from the federal level and not necessarily the state or the local level. People in Northern California don't want it. The state doesn't want it.
Don't you think they should have? People who are trying to do this should have had a conversation with some people here.
Kind of the thing, you know. Right now, it's pretty crusty between the feds and the state, and they're kind of going in divergent ways. You know, and there's the issue of, well, you know, can the feds do that? Can the state do that? Does the federal government have to, you know, go with priority is really dicey, and it's hard to figure out where it is. I mean, they're bickering over the Sacramento River temperature management plan, which is a requirement, you know, that the Bureau of Reclamation has to present this plan to how they're going to manage Shasta Dam so that the fish in the river below the dam will survive, because they have, you know, salmon are cold water fish, so they have to provide cold water to those fish in the river, else they'll die. So they have to put together this plan. But the feds have, you know, the state's saying you have to do all this, and the feds are saying, well, maybe this and maybe that, and we'll do this and we'll do that. I mean, this is, you know, the way it's headed now. There's already a lot of litigation between the feds and the states, and I'm imagining that's only going to continue.
Yeah. I know, you know, you mentioned the salmon. I know there's a discussion on the reintroduction of the winter run Chinook salmon. And, you know, and people are saying, well, can the fish eat their way out of climate change? That's a big concern, too. I know Chris Davies is an avid fisherman. I'm sure he cares about that, what's going to happen. And, Chris, did you ever go fishing up in that area?
Yeah, several times. As a matter of fact, about all over the state, there aren't many fishing holes I haven't thrown a line into.
Well, I think that this whole idea of fish being able to eat themselves out of climate change, I mean, that's actually really fascinating, because actually what they have found is when there's, you know, as that the salmon can have a better tolerance for temperature if they have more food. There's a, you know, I mean, sure, there's a point where it's too hot and they won't be able to survive that. But there's this whole range where if they have access to food, they just need to eat more food and they can, you know, get past those hotter temperatures. They can survive them. And there's so much work going on right now in the Sacramento Valley with restoring these floodplains and flooding them. And when you flood the rice fields, there's all kinds of fish food that comes from that. And they have found great success in putting water on the fields in the wintertime and then flushing that water out to the river or putting it into the flood bypass. They just built a whole gate system in the Yolo Bypass, which is a flood bypass that goes by the side of Sacramento. And what they're going to do is put water into this bypass and fish. And when they go on to these flooded rice fields, they're going to get a lot more food, and they're going to get bigger, and they're going to go out to the ocean in better shape. They found when they have fish in the river versus fish in the rice field that was flooded, the fish in the river are very small and scrawny, and the fish in the rice field are fat, because the rice field flooded will bring forth all this fish food, this phytoplankton and zooplankton and the little things in the water that the fish eat. I mean, it's really, you know, there was a time when I would look at the salmon and I would just say, how are we ever going to deal with this? But I actually found that this, you know, ability to eat themselves out of climate change, so to speak, is really, it really gives hope that, you know, the species can survive. And salmon have been on this earth. They've actually found them in fossils. They've been on this earth for like 50,000 years. And I mean, I'm not exaggerating. And they've survived so many things. You know, landslides and glaciers and no glaciers, and I mean, all these things. So the ability of the species to survive climate change is actually a reality. The salmon is very adaptable. We just need to make sure that we're giving them the right tools to be able to survive. And flooding the rice fields is one of those things. So.
That's the way to do it, I guess. Hey, one other thing, and I was going to ask you, you're in more in tune to a lot of these meetings than I am, and Chris, and so I know NorCal is always worried about clean water. They struggle to provide clean drinking water in some of the areas, the Central Valleys and such. I don't regularly see reports on what's happening with all of those little communities that have really bad water, and really who's taking care of it and what's the deadlines. I don't see a timetable for a lot of those things. Is that something that they talk about but kind of keep low, or it doesn't seem to be right up at the forefront?
You have to be a little bit realistic in the sense that Newsom signed a bill that was going to provide this water, or $130 million a year to provide safe and reliable water to communities that need it. But, once he signs that, that doesn't mean instantly it's there. I mean, the State Water Board has to develop a program, and they have to develop guidelines for who's going to get the water or who's going to get the money, how much, and all of that. So the first year was really spent in figuring out how to put the nuts and bolts of the program together to start, being able to move this money out. And as a matter of fact, I believe in today's digest, the very first recipient of funding under this new program went to a Coachella Valley elementary school, in order for them to get clean water and better infrastructure in the school. So the money is starting to roll. Excuse me, I'm sorry, hiccuping. It's starting to roll out, but it takes some time. It's sort of like, when we vote on a ballot measure, it's not like the next day it happens. I mean, there's always this planning, especially when there's money involved. I mean, they had to do guidelines. They had to, figure out what they were going to do. They had to set up staff. I mean, there was a lot of things that they had to do. So it did take some time. But the money is starting to roll out. And so hopefully we're going to start seeing some real solutions on the horizon for these communities that have bad drinking water.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing, and I as I've always said on this show and even outside the show, I gotta believe in the country as big and smart and wealthy as we are, that we can't find ways to make sure that everybody in this country has access to clean drinking water, legal, illegal, doesn't matter to me. Just as human beings, to be able to provide clean water. And I'm a big proponent of that. I'll always stand for that. And
I think that the Newsom administration has really said, that this is the problem that we can solve, and, this is what we're going to do. I think in other ways, other things have sort of seemed to take a back seat, in terms of this water quality control plan for the Delta, which is, started in 2009, is way overdue, and there just doesn't seem to be any movement on that, for a long time. However, it's great to see that they're doing something about another long-time program or another long-time problem, which is these contaminated drinking water. It really affects the people who can afford it the least. And there's actually, besides this, safe and affordable drinking water program, there are other programs in the works to help provide clean drinking water to these communities in the Central Valley.
Yeah. I just wish it would be promoted more widely to the public so they see what's happening and show that there is an effort to make this all better. So, well, Chris, we're going to head to our commercials. We do appreciate you, as always, for coming on the show. And for our listeners, please go to mavensnotebook.com. It's a great website. Become a sponsor. Become a reader of this thing. I get reports every single morning. I don't know how you do it, Chris, every single day. I turn my computer on first thing in the morning, and boom, I see everything that you've done. And it's unbelievable. And as a group of one, you're doing unbelievable work. So we appreciate
guys.
It. Thanks for making this so great. All right, we'll be back in just a few minutes. Just a couple words from our sponsor. We'll be back with one of our featured guests. So stick around.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
Time to take a water break and talk some water. Irrigation. Such a refreshing topic. As more and more markets face water restrictions, your customers may be hungry, or should I say thirsty, for water-saving products. For new installations, add options like drip irrigation, controllers that respond to weather data, pressure-regulating heads, or heads with check valves. They all provide easy ways to differentiate your bids and win more jobs. Or for an extra stream of revenue, offer existing customers upgrades like high-efficiency nozzles, rotary nozzles, or Wi-Fi-based controllers. Because when you help your customers save water, you make a world of difference for the earth and your bottom line at the same time. We'll drink to that.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Well, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes. A better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
All right, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone Show. We appreciate everybody listening in, and we're going to bring on one of our featured guests. The gentleman's name is John McIntyre, and he's the Managing Director for the American Family Insurance Institute for Corporate and Social Impact. With more than 25 years of experience as a venture capitalist, entrepreneur, and business executive in Silicon Valley, and also around the world, John brings the passion for working with entrepreneurs to the Institute, whose mission is to close equity gaps in America. And the Institute invests in visionary entrepreneurs who are building sociable enterprises in the areas of economic opportunity for all, healthy youth development, learning and achievement, resilient communities.
Yeah, hey, Rob, let me add a couple of things to that, because I'm going to hopefully say that we can say the American Family Insurance Institute for Corporate and Social Impact can be reduced to an acronym that goes by the term of AMFAM. What do you think?
I like that.
So before we bring John on, just a couple of more things about him. At the AmFam Institute, John has been instrumental. He's led a lot of investment projects, many exciting ones. One is called BioDot. It's a company that tests wastewater, and I think the view of is that this testing will provide some insights into public health. I think there's an MIT connection there somewhere. We'll have to ask John as we get into the interview. Another is called Block Power, which has driven financial innovation to electrify 5 million small to medium-sized buildings to use renewable energy. And the last one that we'll talk about a lot tonight is called Storm Center. It really provides a cloud-based water monitoring platform designed to offer real-time data and insights that tracks storm water as it flows through their systems and sort of gives you a look at the impact it has on underrepresented communities, I think. Sort of as I was reading in some of the words, in some of the online stuff, kind of Google for sewers, if you will. So hopefully John can comment on that a little later. Before joining the AmFam team, John worked as a vice president at Kauffman Fellows Network. He was a managing director of Citrix Startup Accelerator, so quite a background there. He is a Kauffman Fellow and a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering from Marquette University. John, welcome and thanks for joining us here on the Water Zone. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be here. Thanks for that kind of long but nice introduction.
we want to make sure people get a good reference to you. So, give us a start first on what the Institute's all about. I understand that you haven't been around for long. You just celebrated a 2-year milestone. So tell us first about the Institute.
Yeah, that's great. And thank you for, you already shortened our long name already, so I don't have to explain that. We just go by the AmFam Institute. First, I should explain who AmFam is, the insurance company. It's a 90-year-old insurance company based here in Madison, Wisconsin, but it's now a national company with lots of different brand names under their umbrella. So in California, you may not have heard of American Family Insurance, but we have other brands like HomeSight, The General, Main Street America, and most recently, Ameriprise Insurance was purchased by us. We now call it Connect. And a lot of our customers buy those insurance products through Costco. So we have lots of different insurance brands that we manage across that.
It's out here in Arizona as well.
Yeah. And so that's our parent corporation and also our so-called limited partner. They gave us money to invest into these innovative, mission-driven startups. And so that is what we're all about at the Institute. So our mission is to really grow corporate responsibility to the next level. And that's why we're using venture capital as one model to do that. As you probably know, being in California, a lot of people understand how venture capital works. You invest in startups, you invest in a group of them, so you have a portfolio of them. And if some of them are successful, you make enough money so you can keep investing in more startups. So we're applying that model for social impact. We want to have positive impact in the world, and that's why AmFam, the insurance company, set us up as a venture capital institute. You already kind of touched on the areas we're focused on, but the one I think is most relevant to talk about tonight is what we call resilient communities. So the investment thesis there is around climate change. It's happening. It's man-made. We need to bring technology to bear, to adjust to it, to mitigate it, hopefully. And so those three companies you mentioned are some of the investments we've made over the last couple of years, because we've only been in business for, as you say, just about 2 years.
Now, I learned of you through the Global Waterworks and the things that you do with what was called Blue 102 and things of that sort. Maybe you can tell us a little about, tell our listeners about that. We know what it is, but our listeners would like to hear from you.
So what's really cool is, you know, there's a whole community of people that work in the water industry, in many different places in the water industry. So obviously, we're all very aware of our local utilities that take care of our, you know, hopefully provide clean water. Of course, and there's struggles there that we see across the country with our infrastructure. And also we have to manage quantity now. So quality and quantity are issues that our country, as around the world, is dealing with. To manage over the long term with climate change. Within that water community, you know, what I focus on is, the startups, the new companies that are bringing great new solutions to the marketplace. And so, like all startup ecosystems, it takes a lot of help to get these companies off the ground. So established water companies that may have been around for many years and have money to spend, often will partner or pilot new technologies from startup companies. Venture capital firms like us will invest in them. And we all work together to hopefully bring the next generation of great companies in water to the marketplace. Of course, they won't all succeed, but some of them will. And they'll be the big growth companies of the future. So the Water Council is a group we're working with based in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to bring one of those programs where we help these startups together. Which I can talk a little bit more about.
Mm-hmm. So I know they have contests every single year. We've had some of their winners on the show over the last couple of years. We had Mary Eckert on the show and things of that sort. Frank Slavonic, met him and other people. And I think they serve an absolute wonderful purpose because, you know, big companies are big companies. I mean, big corporations, lots of money, and there's always the corporate structure getting things. And it takes sometimes a long time because of bureaucracies, where when you have a startup, you don't have all of those issues. You don't have to run it through 20,000 people and have go to board meetings all the time. You know, if it's a small invested company with a few investors, it's just a phone call telling them, you know, giving them an update. But, you know, at the end of the day, they're competing against the big guys. And two things they'd like to do. They want to develop a product that maybe they're hoping some big company will join in with them and you know, sponsor them and then put them under their wing, or they're going out looking for the big dollars to do it on their own, which is even harder to do when you're small trying to compete with the big giants. But what you're doing is a good path. And you know, the Milwaukee projects, there's been some really exciting technology that's come out of that. We've been excited talking to some of those people.
Absolutely. They've done a great job over the last 5-6 years. They've had this program called Brew, which is an accelerator. So, you know, there's lots of accelerators in different market segments. You know, there's literally in California hundreds of them, of course. But here in the Midwest, there's a big focus on freshwater, as you know, and that's why the Water Council started this program 5-6 years ago. They have re-engineered it, and they're calling it Brew 2, and we at the AmFam Institute are supporting them as the core sponsor of that program that they're launching just this month. So actually, in next week, I believe, they're opening up applications. And they're targeting now a slightly different audience of startups that have already done one or two accelerators. Like there's a really good one in San Francisco called Imagine H2O. If you've already gone through some of those programs and you have a product, you may have some level of revenues, and now you want to kind of take the next step as a startup, a later stage startup, that's how they're designing the program now, to bring those companies to work with some of the 240 companies we have here in a cluster in the Midwest that might be able to buy their product or partner with their product or do pilots with them. And sometimes they do buy those startups as well. So that, those are all outcomes, obviously, we're looking for.
Yeah. Well, coming from a big company that Chris and I work for, which is the Toro Company, we do the same thing. We get hit regularly with new people coming and say, look, we've developed this product. Are you interested in it? And some of them are really innovative. I'm not going to say we never did any deals with them. We have. But sometimes they bring something to us that we're already working on, so we pass on it. But that's the idea. When you do the startup, your objective is to make the product and get the funding and do the marketing. That's the only way you get successful at this thing.
What's really cool about the Institute I want to mention is just, you know, that is the innovation process that has been created in the United States and Silicon Valley over the last 50, 60 years that really brings us the next generation of companies. But now trying to apply it, to use that for social impact, not just for the good of our company, our parent company and its strategic interest, but for the good of society overall. And that's why we're doing this, not necessarily to help American Family Insurance, but to help our community, to help our customers, help our future employees live in better communities. Because as you just were talking about in the last half hour, who's looking for us to have clean water in the next, you know, 100 years? What technologies are coming to market? If we don't have clean water, what do we do? How are we going to manage sea level change? And here in the Midwest, you know, are the Great Lakes and the wonderful small lakes and rivers and streams we have are the highest they've ever been. So this is we all know this is a long-term thing we have to deal with climate change, and that's what's motivating a lot of our investment.
Right. You know, there's things such as atmosphere water harvesting, taking the algae bloom out of the water and creating, you use them for vitamins, which is really funny, but they also use it for for power and energy and things of that sort. And there's a big deal with that. And I know, and I do want to talk about, because I do want to give you guys kudos on your corporate responsibility, what your company does as a whole, and how you're structuring that with your plans that you have over the next, you know, 10 to 20 years. And then what you do with different things. You have things I want to talk about, like Dream Bank and Dreams Foundation things of that sort, because you're doing a lot of things for people, for the environment, for the communities. And that's you know, it's the question we're doing one on our CEO and chairman of the board. And one of the questions that we're going to ask is, you know, do you believe there's another purpose of the company besides making money?
Right.
And I see that with your organization, because it's more than just, yes, you're in business to make money, but now you're doing some other things that, you know, you want to see happen. You want to see people dream fearlessly and all of that. And that's a good thing. I mean, we all, there's a responsibility that every company should have to a point. And if they can help, that's a wonderful thing. So maybe you can talk about some of the programs aside from that, what you're doing on the sustainability side.
Well, sure. And, you know, I think this is a trend. So the Business Roundtable last summer, not this last summer, 2020, but 2019, came out with a statement, a position, it was in the New York Times, that said the purpose of corporations isn't just to make money. And certainly we believe in making money because that makes you sustainable and scalable, but also to do good for your communities, for your countries, for the world. And so that's definitely what we believe. So doing good is good business, is a fundamental mm-hmm. belief. And I think that is a change from a decade ago or 2 decades ago. I don't think most CEOs thought that way, but there's an increasing group of them that do today. So we do have a lot of programs that we've launched for corporate responsibility and corporate sustainability at American Family. And I think what I think about is not just what we're doing, but the community of corporations, because we know working for corporations, we have a lot of the ability to influence policy. We have a lot of dollars, if we're profitable companies, that we can put into our communities. So we do have several foundations. We have a golf tournament we do here in Wisconsin every year. The Steve Stricker Golf Foundation supports that, a charitable golf tournament. We work with a lot of the sports franchises, the universities, and so on, to really try to build a coalition of organizations that work together to try to do good things in the world. So for me, though, what really, you know, across all those things we do, what really does get me excited is going back to the startups, because you mentioned a couple of them in your introduction that I have to mention again. One of them, you mentioned coming out of MIT BioBot, they just kind of launched in the last few years, and they were focusing on testing wastewater for drugs, chemicals, bacteria, and turns out they can also detect COVID-19. And when you detect it in wastewater, you have the ability to get a leading indicator about the health of a community. And so this whole science of wastewater now is in a position to help us with public health, because we can get a look into the overall health of our communities through the wastewater. So there's about a 3 to 7 day lead we can see if COVID has entered our community and it's spiking up. So BioBot is going to be a hot startup, no doubt about it. They're growing very quickly this year, so keep an eye on them, because I think this.
Do you think that technology, instead of using it for wastewater or sewage, that they could come up with a test for the pharmaceutical world to use? Somebody would just urinate in a little bottle and, oh, cool.
Well, their first product that they documented and brought to the market in 2017-18 and into 19 was an opioid product. So they can detect opioids in wastewater, and so you can see with demographic information exactly how much opioid usage is going on in your community, and you can tell also, because they have great specificity in their testing, how much of it is over-the-counter, or not over prescription, and how much is illegal street drugs. So Curie, North Carolina, used that information to design programs to try to help their community with the opioid crisis. So that was their first product, and then COVID did. And so that's their second product, and they'll have a product with flu and other products in the future. So they'll be a water company to watch, and that whole area is going to be really hot, I think, in the next few years. The other water company you mentioned is Storm Sensor. So it's amazing that most of our municipalities don't really have any idea, say, when we have a storm and there's lots of water running through our storm systems and our sewer systems, the flow that's actually happening. They have very few of them sensored at all. So they're able to put sensors in the sewer, so it's a Google Maps of sewer systems, and really help with the flooding issues. And as mentioned in the last half hour, it's the poorest communities that usually take the brunt of the flooding. So if we can actually get the data we need to understand what's going on in our infrastructure, in our sewer systems, we can correctly apply upgrades to our systems to prevent that flooding and to, you know, upgrade, an aging sewer system across the United States.
Yeah. And you know, sewer systems, I'm sure you know, they do need some water traveling through it. Otherwise, it doesn't function as it's supposed to. And a lot of them don't get flushed out, and it causes lots of serious problems. So
yeah,
that's important.
A big problem.
Yeah. How do organizations, or how do you find entities that are looking for help, or do they come find you? And how does that work?
Well, we have a team that surveys the market, and we try to get smart in these different areas. Like I said, we call resilient communities, education and academic achievement, economic opportunity for all. So we look out in the marketplace and what's happening. And of course, 2020 is a year we'll never forget because of not only the pandemic, but the crisis that we've been thrown into with the economy. So where are the next jobs going to come from? Not just next year or the year after, but the next 20 years. New technologies like artificial intelligence we know is going to eliminate some jobs. But that's always been the case. We're always eliminating jobs, but we always need to be creating jobs. So what innovation engines are all about, startups, is looking at where the job destruction is happening over at one place, and then working to create the next generation of jobs and focusing on that. So I do believe that green infrastructure and rebuilding America's infrastructure is where jobs will be for people in the trade, in construction, hopefully for the next 20, 30 years. We need policy to support that, but we also need investment. And it's not just public investment. Part of what we're working on is financial innovation. You mentioned this company, BlockPower, we invested in. They're bringing private sector money to upgrade these older commercial and multi-residential buildings across the country, starting in New York City. And so there's a lot of private money that will go into this infrastructure development if it's innovative and it's shown that you can manage the risk. And we have the tools to do that today that we didn't used to have. So we look across all these areas and, of course, pick what investments we can make and then try to be leaders, corporate leaders here. And as we were talking about it a minute ago, I think there is a movement underfoot in corporate America to really try to support our country like never before, given the resources we have.
Mm-hmm. Wholeheartedly,
John, for sure. So let me ask another question, because I appreciate you talking about BioBot and Storm Sensor, because it knocked two questions off my question list for you. But I'm really interested in asking a question about sort of the investment philosophy a little bit, right? You've told us about what you invest in and kind of how you invest a little bit. So, you know, is there a process you have? What's sort of your presence in a new investment? You know, how far do you go? How far do you take your influence?
Well, like any venture capital firm, what you're really looking at, a lot of these early stage startups have a product under development. Maybe it's just come to market, but there's usually not a lot of revenue yet. So you have to believe that they're going after a big enough market with a product that really is innovative or hits a niche that bigger companies have missed or aren't interested in. So you look at the business model, and probably even more important than that, who are these people, and what are the backgrounds that led them to this, and their motivations and so on. And today what's really important, too, is diversity and inclusion. So I started doing venture capital back in Silicon Valley in the 1990s, and I think, you know, shame on us, we did a poor job of creating companies and initiatives that included people of color and women in the tech industry. And if we would have done it back then, I think we'd be in a lot better shape today. But we have to start now, and we need to do better. So we look for companies that are diverse as well, that have founders that have diverse backgrounds and diverse ways of thinking about solving problems. So that's always what venture capitalists think about. The other thing that I mentioned earlier is we're also trying to bring in a social impact measurement of some sort. So how does this solution help people in communities of need? And again, in water, it's kind of not that hard to imagine. Like, we know that there's poor quality water, drinking water across the United States, and we need more solutions to come to market at lower price points so we can detect that and fix that. And then the same issues we have with water quantity management are happening too. So we look for a social impact story as well as a business model and a team who can go attack that problem.
I think that's a great answer to that question, John. You took out again two of the follow up questions I had for that by explaining it really well, right? So looking at diversity, as you said, building hey, I belong here. This is something that's a part of me. Developing that organization to work, you know, with the people that it's got and to work with the community that it's got, looking for visionary entrepreneurs, all those kind of things. Those are important in startup businesses, don't you agree?
Absolutely. And so some things, you know, we know work and will continue to do. Some things we need to change to make our society a better place. We have to change our thinking in some areas so that we're creating, you know, the next generation of jobs for everybody in our country and not just for select groups.
How are you guys holding up in the age of COVID?
I'm sorry to report. I moved here to Wisconsin from Northern California last year that we're the hot spot at the moment.
Yeah.
Wisconsin's not doing well at the moment. Hopefully we'll get through this. And, you know, all I can say is I do believe it is a function of wearing masks. And when you've been in the early hotspot areas like California and Seattle and New York, learned the lesson, and now you guys are in a much better shape. Now, we're all still suffering from this, but I think that's the big lesson that we've learned about how this spreads so easily. What I really worry about is the economy and creating these next new jobs. And, of course, what the pandemic has done is it's done some negative things to our economy, and we are having social unrest that we must acknowledge and respond to in a positive manner. But I do think it accelerates some things that we needed to get to anyway. So in some ways, the silver lining is we're finding where the cracks are in our economy faster. And hopefully we can fix those things for longer term success for the economy.
When you invest in some of these new entities, do you do more than just fund dollars? Do you provide leadership expertise? I mean, sometimes this company's a great idea, but they really need somebody who can handle operations, or they need somebody who's really a marketing person. I mean, you include that into your analysis and how you select these companies and what you invest.
Yeah, most, but not all, venture investors or other investors do value-added services, but most of us do try. And I have to say to your listeners, go to our website. It's the amfaminstitute.com. And it's a better-than-average website because we have a storyteller on our staff. His name's Adam Schrager. He was a reporter for a number of years, and now he tells stories about the problems we have in society, but also these great startups and how they're fixing those problems. So he helps those startups, too, with their marketing and positioning and how they present themselves and so on. So we do that kind of thing. And then, as we mentioned earlier, we work with accelerators and other ecosystem players to help them. At the end of the day, you know, everybody needs to get revenue, so they have to sell. So particularly like in the water market, there's a particular way you sell into the water market to municipalities and corporations. So you need to develop the sales skills. You have to develop the right people on your team to be able to do that. So that's always a big one that we try to help with, hiring the right people for go-to-market reasons. Engineering, of course, is always a big deal. Super competitive, great to get engineers and startups to build these great new products. So try to help cross all aspects of those startups. And usually we serve on the board for major investors too. So we'll try to assist CEO and her team to build these companies over time.
Okay. We're up against our news hour, and I'd like to get back with you again, maybe in a relatively short time, and maybe bring one of your companies that you've sponsored, and let's explore that a little bit more. So we appreciate it. We're up against our news hour, so we have to go. We thank you very much.